Blog Talk Radio.
Hoping to get you back up and fully away. When your life is at stake, I'm just doing what it takes. Do you have the heart to be an EMT? Do you have the bravery to be a firefighter? When things get hectic, when they get tragic, do you have the courage to be a paramedic? Made of the few, only rare select. Stand up, show yourself, command respect. Show them what you got. Show them who you are with the patch on your shoulder, saving lives. Blue Star.
And with 133 days, 9 hours, 29 minutes, 19 seconds left until the big dance in Vegas, this is One Union 801, the webcast. I am John Broyles, SSGJ Broyles on Twitter, John.Broyles1 on Facebook. 347-826-7894 is the number to call in to talk to our guests tonight, all three of them. We got Scott Snyder. We got Kevin Kalapi, we got Sean Kevlahan, and we're going to be doing some myth busting. We're going to be busting the top trauma myths, as in their EMS World article from March of this year. Just a couple quick notes real quick. This Saturday night will be our regular show, and we will have the Paraguides on talking about their season 2. With Sean Allen, that's going to be a great show. And then the following show after that, 2 weeks from Saturday, we are going to have author Jared Edgington talking about the Racing the Reaper series, which he has just finished up. So I'm going to go ahead and bring on our guests. There's a one, there's a two, and good evening, gentlemen.
Hello, John. How are you?
Hey. Here we all are.
There we are.
So, I do know that I was going through the web today and saw something about Kevin and Sean. Are you guys going to be somewhere on the West Coast in September, somewhere out west where it's nice and warm?
Las Vegas? Yeah, we'll be there.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad to see that you gentlemen will be teaching. Will be teaching in Vegas. It's going to be definitely fun, and I'm still trying to get out there. So, let's see here. Like I say, I know I have a as soon as I click the right thing. Kevin and Sean, I know you guys have been on the show before, but I was a dummy. I didn't really do all my homework, so how about a little background? Let's start off with you, Kevin. And see here, you're a critical care paramedic.
I am. I'm a critical care and flight paramedic out in Wilmington, North Carolina. Actually, the education coordinator there and oversee our program's initial and continuing education, and have also overtaken our company's research program. We are just about to publish our fourth clinical trial. We're submitting it this week for publication. So
wow.
That's really exciting. I've been in EMS for about 15 years now.
Sweet. And Dr. Kevlahan, Sean, how about, can we have a little of your background while we're...
Yeah, definitely. My name is Sean, and I am the ER chief president at UCSF, University of California in San Francisco. Before that, I was a paramedic in New York City for about 10 years, and I ran a lot of the education programs out there. And I'm actually in Boston right now, apartment hunting for my new job after I graduate at the end of June, where I will be at the Brigham and Women's Hospital as their International Emergency Medicine Fellow, helping develop EMS systems around the world.
Holy. Yeah, you're going to be busy.
Yeah, a little bit. It's fun, though.
Just a little. And then, Scott, how about, all I can see here is that you're just a National Registered Paramedic, so let's hear some of your background before we tear apart this article.
Let's do that. My name is Scott Snyder. I'm currently a full-time faculty member at Santa Rosa Junior College at the Public Safety Training Center, where I teach in the EMT and paramedic programs. And actually, our training center is pretty unique. We not only have EMS academies for EMTs and paramedics, but we also do fire and law enforcement training as well. We have our own separate campus off the main campus, which is a pretty nice resource. I'm also a part-time paramedic with AMR Sonoma Life Support in Santa Rosa, California.
Sweet.
And like Sean, I originally hail from New York. We're actually old paramedic friends from both of us from New York, now transplanted out to California. But sad to say, I will not be going to Boston.
To Boston?
Where Sean is Vegas? Going. And Kurt?
You see,
no, I mean, to
right
Boston,
now,
where Sean is going. I'm staying behind. And I will be in Vegas, EMS World, although I'll be going purely this year as a participant, taking a step back and just enjoying the conference, what it has to offer.
Ah, enjoying the party. Okay.
Well, don't downplay Scott's contribution. Scott's the reason all three of us are sitting here tonight and all of us are working together. Scott's really been the driver in all of us getting into EMS writing and EMS writing on a national level. He was the textbook author and column author and contributor long before any of us, and kind of found Sean and I along the way and brought us on, and we've been lucky enough to do this together for 5 years now.
Oh, wow. All right. So I was going through my March issue of EMS World, and I came across y'all's article, which, and then I sent it to the EMS club at my school, and everybody's like, yeah, whatever. And I'm like, okay, if you guys don't want the continuing ed out of it, I'll go ahead and take it. But it looks like it's just destroying some of the stuff that I was taught way, way, way back. My first basic class back that many years ago. In fact, well, I'll go ahead and start off with number one that's listed here. And it's never put a nasal and a head injury. That's got me confused because I've been taught, and I've had it beaten in my head over and over and over. If it's a head injury, you do not put a nasal in because it might go under and violate the soft bone and penetrate the cranium. How's this wrong?
Well, yeah, this is Sean. Let me start with this, and I'll let Kevin tell it up because he did some of the research on this one. But think about it. You have a patient with a head injury, and you're out there in the street. What's the greatest threat to your patient? Is that patient not breathing because they lose their airway and they're gurgling blood because of a head injury, or they're clenched down with their teeth and you can't get a tube through, but their nasal passages are still open? Or the random chance that that rubber nasopharyngeal airway will go through their basal skull? Turns out the research shows that it's really unlikely that the latter will happen. Getting that nasal trumpet through their head into their brain, we've all seen that really scary picture. That's a pretty rare occurrence, almost impossible. But what's a really common occurrence is you not being able to get an airway and not being able to ventilate your patient with a severe head injury.
Okay, so what are the odds that I would get it through the basilar skull into the cranium?
Well, let's take a look at your anatomy of the nasal airway first. If you look at how we insert a nasal airway, we know we're going to point the bevel inward, and you can either direct it so you're pointing up towards the eyes or you're pointing it straight down towards the hypopharynx. If you follow the anatomy and you follow the base of the nasal airway and you push and you are inserting it gently, directly inferiorly, you're going nowhere near the basilar skull. Your opportunity to take that very soft piece of rubber and push it through bony tissue and bony structures, it is well under a tenth of 1%. That said, if you don't follow the anatomical structures and you point directly towards the eyes and you meet resistance and you continue to force it, absolutely you can go through the cranium.
Okay, so if I do it, use it the way it's supposed to be used,
and you don't meet resistance,
and is bevel towards the septum and slide it the way it's supposed to go, I'm good to go.
Exactly.
As long as you don't meet resistance,
yeah.
That's the caveat there.
You know, I think you have to realize if this were something that were a common occurrence, we would all know of a situation in which this happened. We would hear about it most likely. And I don't know about any of you guys, but I have never heard of this happening. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, there were only 3 case reports written up of this ever occurring. And, you know, as Sean pointed out, you know, these case reports are dramatic and they're usually accompanied with things like, you know, imaging studies that clearly show the lumen of a NPA up into someone's cranium. And while it is our goal to oxygenate the brain, We don't do it directly. We go through the lungs. That's our goal here. But that's a bad thing. But, you know, as we've been pointing out, I think in the hands of a competent person who is using it correctly, using proper technique, and not forcing the issue and not forcing the nasal airway in, I think the likelihood that you are going to effortlessly place this thing into someone's cranium through a defect in the basilar skull is slim to none. I think when we're talking about using a NPA in the presence of a suspected basilar skull fracture, it shouldn't be that the contraindication is a basilar, the possibility of a basilar skull fracture. The contraindication should be the possibility of a basilar skull fracture, and you're completely, clueless about how to use this tool, because in the hands of a trained provider who is careful and considerate, again, like everyone else, I think it's pretty darn hard to stick this thing where it's not supposed to be. You're probably doing something wrong.
Okay, so it's the way we've always been taught, the rubber hose up the nose.
Right.
And let's remember, we are not talking about nasal intubation, and we are not talking about placing
right.
a nasal gastric tube in the presence of a head injury. Those are two completely separate conversations that are not a part of nasal airway placement.
All right, and good thing to emphasize that we are talking about the nasal trumpet, the NPA, the nose hose, whatever you want to call it. Okay, so the bottom line is go for it. All right, I'll make sure to tell my instructor that one. Go for it. I like this. I'm definitely going to fail my internship now because I'm going to know more than him. Okay, the second myth you got. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you bring up a good point though about just continuing education and papers like this, our myth article. If you're going out and seeking good CE and you're learning about this stuff, you very well may find yourself in a position where you have more information about current trends, about things as simple as the NPA, than the people around you. I think it's really important that you, when you learn about something like this, you take the opportunity to share it with your colleagues before you're in a situation where you're using it, because that's not the time to bring something new up. It's, you talk about that beforehand, you integrate it into your training, you make it the information available, to everyone in your agency, maybe get your medical director on board to change practice. But this is not something that, you pull out. If you're a paramedic intern, you don't want to be breaking this information out and getting into the conversation the first time on a head injured patient when your preceptor is expecting something different.
Okay. So we're not going to see this in ITLS anytime soon then.
Well, you might be surprised. This is the whole point of continuing education. We're learning every day. We don't always know what the right answer is, and things change, because new evidence comes out. So I think that this and the other 9 points we're going to talk about are all parts of that change that's ongoing. That's why it's important to keep reading and keep learning. You're never done learning in this field.
I found that out after 15 years of being basic.
And some of the authors of the research that has said the NPA is safe for head injuries are the same authors that developed the Advanced Trauma Life Support Curriculum for Emergency and Trauma Surgeons. And the trickle-down effect from ATLS to PHTLS and ITLS really doesn't take as long as people suspect.
Oh. Okay. So let's move on to number two. It's a number two trauma myth here. Lidocaine in RSI prevents increased ICP. Okay, now this one is definitely right above my level because I'm just an AEMT intern. So naturally, my level, we don't do RSI. I understand that lidocaine is a and I'm drawing a blank. Before I really put my
lidocaine
go ahead.
Lidocaine does lots of really good things for us. Lidocaine is an analgesic or an anesthetic. It can numb your IO if you are establishing an intraosseous needle on someone. It is a cardioprotectant. It will decrease cardiac irritability. Where it's never been proven, never been studied, is pre-hospital RSI. There are a couple of case series from the operating room when doctors were doing neurosurgery on patients with already elevated intracranial pressures and on patients who had ICP monitors in place in the intensive care units before they performed particularly painful procedures, and they watched what the effect of lidocaine would be on those patients when given immediately before either poking the brain or doing those painful procedures. And while there was an effect, there was a decrease in ICP compared to no lidocaine administration. The effect was not clinically significant, nor were any of those effects ever directly related to endotracheal intubation itself as a procedure.
Okay, so it. Now, thing is, I do remember that lidocaine is time dependent. How much time between giving the lido to actually putting a laryngoscope in and lifting up before it doesn't have an effect?
Well, it's not just time dependent, but it's also the time of onset is a little slow. And one of the big problems with using lidocaine for intubation is the lidocaine doesn't work immediately. It needs to get in through the cell membrane. And for that to happen, sorry, I have a, an ambulance by of all things. So it's very fitting for our show. But anyway, for that to happen, it needs 30 to 60 seconds to settle in. And that's not going to happen when you're doing an RSI procedure. You're trying to intubate somebody in a crash situation. The whole idea of lidocaine for head injuries and to prevent intracranial pressure increases was really never proven, and it was kind of almost a random suggestion that hasn't ever borne out in the literature. So I think that we shouldn't be doing it.
Okay, now, which is the best dose? Is it the standard dose of 1.5 mg per kg or bump it up to 2 mg?
Well, that's the thing. We don't have good literature even showing that this is an indicated procedure, but at the same time, we don't even have a proposed dose. So the normal dose that we use intravenously is probably less than what is needed transcutaneously, but we don't even have good studies on what is the adequate dose because we don't even know if the medication works in the way that we think that it works. So I don't think we have the evidence to answer that question.
Okay. So it's basically it's not proven where it's going to rise to prevent a rise, but it's one of those. Help me out on this one. Even though it's not proven to where it'll raise it, but
so I think even though it's not been proven, I think even though it's not been proven to prevent the rise in intracranial pressure, it's a good example of how very often in our industry we're forced to take practices or data and literature from other areas of medicine and try to extrapolate what does that mean in our world and try to apply it in our world. I think this is a good example of that, as Kevin pointed out. You know, the situations we find ourselves in the pre-hospital environment or even the critical care environment where we're performing rapid sequence intubation and using lidocaine in this manner does not in any way come close to what anesthesiologists in the OR with intracranial pressure monitoring devices in place are doing. So I think it's a good example of that. It's we don't know if it works. Sounds great. Let's try it and incorporate it. But at the end of the day, we don't know if it's a benefit, if it's detrimental, or if it doesn't matter. You know, it's funny. I think of intracranial pressure. It increases in ICP in head injury patients. During intubation attempts, and I think about things like, why don't I set myself up to give myself the best opportunity to spend as little time as possible inside this person's airway with a laryngoscope, you know, causing them to gag, if I'm not performing RSI, causing them to gag and have transient and resulting in transient increases in ICP. That's time spent not ventilating and the patient possibly coming hypoxic, which also has a detrimental effect on patients with head injuries. You know, I would like to worry more about that, quite frankly, when we're talking about headed your patients getting RSI rather than does lidocaine work or not? Because at the end of the day, we don't know. What we do know is if your patient becomes hypoxic, that's going to worsen brain injury. If they're fighting against an attempt at laryngoscopy because you don't have the benefit of RSI, that's increasing intracranial pressure, and lidocaine is not going to help you. I'd like for us to pay more attention to that and good airway and intubation technique and, putting ourselves in a position where we're experts at, the BLS airway and ventilating and properly oxygenating beforehand, as well as, intubating a patient and performing laryngoscopy.
Okay. Let's truck on over to myth number three, which is gaining ground all over the place, believe it or not. In fact, I heard a little bit about it in ITLS and when I was doing my trauma portion of my AEMT class. Backboards are helpful only as a patient movement device. The last part was added by me. Myself and one of my instructors. We all know that backboards are uncomfortable, they're hard, they're rigid, they don't conform to the body the way a vacuum mat can. Is there anything more than what we already know about these hard benches?
Well, first of all, there was never any evidence showing that backboards work, ever. It was something that was extrapolated from it being used as a patient movement device. And then once we started doing studies on it, we showed repeatedly that it had no benefit, and cadaver studies where they actually attached sensors in the spine to look for movement showed that it didn't restrict movement. So it didn't even work in the way that we thought it worked. And then other studies showed it causes pain in almost everybody. If you take healthy volunteers and have them lay down on the backboard, they all have pain within a half hour, people that didn't have pain before. And the elderly develop sacral decubes on it. So we only have negatives. We have no positives on this device. So I think it's about time that we've moved on and that people have started to call out for us to stop using it. You are right, though, in what you say, that it's good for a movement device. And in the field, it is very useful as a movement device. But outside of that, I think that's about it.
Either that or take two of them and make a bench out of them.
or a sled.
There is a good place for spinal motion restriction in our industry. Spinal motion restriction has proven it's effective, it's safe for patients. All spinal motion restriction means is that you control the heavyweight centers that affect movement of the spine. Those are the head, the shoulders, and the hips. If you can control those three regions of a patient's body, you can control them on a mattress, you can control them on a stretcher, you can control them in a bed. The addition of a backboard provides you no additional protection to that patient than simply controlling those in whatever position they're in. In fact, there's good evidence that a patient will stay still more effectively when on a mattress than they will on the backboard. On the backboard, like Sean said, they're going to become uncomfortable, develop pain, and they're going to want to shift and move around, whereas there's a greater likelihood on the mattress they'll actually remain still.
Well, of course, the mattress also somewhat conforms to the body, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, you're laying down on a mattress, you got your it somewhat comes up and conforms with you, especially if it's a good mattress. Hopefully I'm right.
Yeah. And I want to point out, I think, this is something that I feel that a lot of providers are going to be seeing, no matter where you practice, at least here in the United States, because after the National Association of EMS Physicians position paper on the statement, that gave the green light for medical directors to move forward with spinal motion restriction protocols that give more freedom to EMS providers in the field to make those decisions. You know, is the use of a long spine board and head immobilization necessary, or can we operate somewhere within a spectrum of absolutely no spinal motion restriction and full immobilization on a backboard? I think you're going to see more and more of that now, after the publication of that position paper. And I'll tell you, that makes the job of the EMS provider more difficult, know, here in Sonoma County, California, we recently adopted a spinal motion restriction protocol that mirrors the recommendations of the National Association of EMS Physicians position paper. And I'll tell you, using those recommendations and our established protocol in the field requires a lot more work on the part of the care provider than it ever did in the past. If you think about it, in the past, you know, it was more or less like, hey, if you might have fallen down and possibly hit your head, you're going to get full spinal mobilization. And when you have, you know, criteria like that, you're going to capture all of those people who do indeed, those very few people who do indeed have spinal trauma, and especially we're concerned about cervical spinal trauma. You're going to capture them when you have such a low threshold. But when you introduce the potential of a spectrum of options, you rely heavily on the care provider to perform a thorough physical and historical assessment in the field and determine what is best for that patient. It actually makes our job a lot more difficult because, you know, it's not just universal now. You really have to think about what's the likelihood for potential injury here based on mechanism, what am I finding on my thorough and complete physical exam and by talking to the patient, and what does my gut tell me, and opt for the best situation, you know, the best immobilization technique for that particular situation, for that patient, for that mechanism, for everything. It's actually a lot more difficult. It puts a lot more emphasis on the clinical acumen of the care provider. So there's a lot of responsibility that comes along with spinal motion restriction protocols.
Okay, well, and that right there is going to make me want to skip over number 4 on y'all's list and go to number 5, since we're on the SMRs. The KED, does it really prevent spinal movement? I mean, all I've used it for was in class to carry somebody from the chair to another chair or to wrap up a little kid. That's all I've ever used a KED for. And Rick Kendrick is I've met him and he slapped me upside the head for saying it and doing it, but excuse me. So it doesn't work?
Well, the KED makes great photos for your EMT students and people to joke about, like you kind of said, but I'm yet to see the convincing evidence that it actually works in its intended purpose.
Okay, I know its intended purpose was basically as a replacement for the short board. Am I correct?
Sort of. Where the KED originated from is actually NASCAR and auto racing. When they had the cars where the only way to get people out was through the rooftop hole or door on the roof because they had the frames built inside of it. So it was designed, again, as an extrication tool for a patient who couldn't get themselves out after an incident. It was never designed for lateral removal from a traditional motor vehicle.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, that's why that loop is actually at the top, the head portion of the Kendrick's extrication device. So that's some sort of, you know, lifting mechanism. I'm not a NASCAR fan, so I don't know, but could actually pick someone straight up and out. Is that not true, Kevin? Or is that?
From what I understand, yeah. Again, I don't see the point in watching a sport where you just turn left for 6 hours.
Careful, buddy.
I watched it once. I was begging for a right.
Yeah, and you know, and there was that one study that showed that you know, people who were told to be careful, you know, were more effective at preventing spinal motion and when they were self-extricating themselves from a vehicle than with a KED, you know. So, and I think that, you know, that's sort of a driving point that we all need to remember. You know, no matter how you're moving a patient, whether it's your log rolling, your, you know, with a number of people lifting someone up, you're placing them in a Kendrick's extrication device, like KED, and you're moving them from a car, we are manipulating those people, and they're not in control. With us not being perceptive as to how they hurt, where they hurt, and what makes them hurt, my guess is we move them around quite a bit, and we hurt them. If you just allow someone to move themselves, tell them to, you know, engage in movements that don't result in any pain. Keep yourself in a position. We're here to help you and support you as you need. People are pretty effective at moving themselves from point A to point B in a manner that doesn't result in manipulation of injuries and pain. I think that's the take-home point. You know, this device doesn't take the place of allowing someone and supporting someone to move on their own in a manner that results in a minimal amount of spinal movement and pain.
Okay, so it basically does no good and it could be worse?
Well, I think, there's a place for it. The study that we referenced looked at patients who are able to self-extricate. That's very, very different than the entrapped patient who's unresponsive inside of a car, who's already in a compromised position, who has evidence of a spine injury and does need some sort of spinal motion restriction in assisting in getting them out of that car. So comparing apples to apples, you can't do that when you're looking at the patient in the study who was able to self-extricate, as Scott described, and self-splint, which is what they're going to do if they have a hurt bone, whether it's in the neck or in the arm, and walk to a stretcher, versus someone who cannot self-extricate out of the car because of extenuated injuries. And in that latter patient, we truthfully don't know what the right answer is going to be.
Yeah, and let's refine that patient who may be a good candidate for a KED. It's not the unstable patient trapped in a car who can't self-extricate, because by definition, they're not candidates for a KED. Let's take the elderly patient who normally has very minimal, very restricted movement, and would have a hard time getting themselves out of a vehicle on any given day, let alone now that they're in an accident. They may be a good candidate for this device to aid them in extricating from a vehicle and with the minimal amount of manipulation of an injury. But the healthy young person complaining of neck pain, I think my anecdotal evidence, and it would seem that the data out there in the literature suggests that those people are able to self-extricate with less movement of their spinal column than with the application of a KED.
Oh, okay. Well, now I'll have something to duck when I see.
Yeah, we're not saying that it's not right for everybody, but there's definitely a population of people that there's probably a better option.
Okay, I'll make sure to have that in mind while I'm low crawling away from Rick Kendrick in Baltimore next year. Now let's go ahead back up one, because I jumped one on the list intentionally. Our favorite position, head down, feet up, Trendelenburg. I know it's supposed to keep all the blood mostly circulating towards the core. Is that true or false?
Well, I'll tell you, going backwards a little bit to head injuries, don't do that to the head injury patient, because you'll probably cause an increase in intracranial pressure.
Obviously. Okay, for the non-head injured patient, the hypovolemic. There we go, the hypovolemic patient.
So let's look back at the original Trendelenburg position, which goes, Sean probably knows this better than I do, but my understanding is it goes back to 1800 when they were looking at abdominal surgery. And its intent was simply to shift the abdominal content for surgery. It had nothing to do with blood pressure.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing is when you... Trendelenburg, it's one of many things that we do that intuitively it seems to make sense. You raise your legs up, it pulls the blood back to the head and the heart and the lungs and all the places that we want the blood. But it also has some negative effects that we don't think about. Oftentimes, these patients are pretty unstable, and we're trying to ventilate them aggressively. When we lay them essentially upside down, all of their stomach contents push down on the lungs and the heart. It can impede respiration, ventilation. It can impede the cardiac function. It's almost the opposite of what you think about if you have a heart failure patient and trying to sit them up to improve ventilation. And we can have some pretty negative effects that can actually reduce cardiac preload by putting their legs up, even though we think that we're bringing the blood in the right place.
Okay.
Yeah, and if you think about how odd that is, if you think about the patients that we'll be putting in Trendelenburg, those patients who are probably, you know, hypotensive and hypovolemic shock, we can actually make them worse. We can make them more hypotensive by decreasing cardiac return and preload and subsequently stroke volume and cardiac output. And we make it more difficult to bag those patients because of all the abdominal contents pushing up on the diaphragm. So that requires higher airway pressure. And with higher airway pressure, we run the risk of more gastric insufflation and eventual regurgitation and possible aspiration. So we're potentially making these unstable patients worse by adopting this position. We're certainly not making it easier for them to maintain an adequate blood pressure and compensate for developing hypovolemic shock, and we're certainly not making it any easier for us to adequately support breathing in these patients.
Okay, so basically don't use Trendelenburg. That'll work.
Probably not a good idea.
Okay, now the next myth, number six, is one that has been taught to me since I was a Cub Scout. And that's quite a few moons ago. It's you never take a dressing off a bleed. You just keep piling them on. They taught me that in Cub Scouts, taught me that in Boy Scouts, taught me that in the Army, taught me that in my basic class. What's wrong with that?
Well, think about it. When you have bleeding, the most important point, if you really think back to all the training that you got, you may not have even realized it, is you need to find where the bleeding is occurring and stop it at the source. All you need is one finger. You find this source of bleeding and you stop it with your finger. Direct pressure is the most important component. This whole adage of not taking bandages off is really not helping anything, because before you know it, you have 24x4s on somebody, and now you've diffused all the pressure, so you're not putting any direct pressure down on that bleed. So sometimes taking it off and just using your finger and pushing it exactly on the point of the bleeding is all that's needed.
Now, I know that the blood does clot up underneath the dressing, so does that affect clotting any? I mean, if I pull that dressing off and the blood is starting to hemolyze and starting to clot, wouldn't that just tear up any of the work that the body's already done?
That's a great point. And the same way that I was taught is that the 4x4 gauze actually helps build the clot. So if you pull it off, you're essentially ripping the clot off. Well, if you need more bandages because of ongoing bleeding, that means the clot isn't forming. It's not working anyway. So you need to take it off and readdress your strategy.
Okay.
I think we need to remember, we're not taught that we're applying direct pressure with a bandage to encourage clot formation. We're applying direct pressure to kink the hose that is leaking fluid, period. You know, that's really what we're doing. And I think the whole idea of clot formation and, you know, blood pooling in a bandage sort of came after the fact. And, yeah, it makes sense, and I can see that happening. But at the end of the day, what is going to stop bleeding immediately? You pinch that hose shut. You pinch that blood vessel, and you stop it from bleeding. That's what stops bleeding. And then a ER doc or a surgeon or somebody goes in there and stops that bleeding surgically.
Okay. See, now it's all clear to me. I'm like, okay. Now I can see why I've been taught wrong all these years. Now, while we're on pressure and bleeding, the 80-70-60, or the way I was taught way long time ago, 90-80-70, the pulse rule. I know my normally silent co-host and call screener gets done hacking up a lung, and I reach down, I feel a radial pulse, I know she has a systolic of at least 80. Am I right, or is this an old wives' tale?
Yeah, it's an old wives' tale. I think it's been shown. I would like for it to have been shown better with more people, you know, with more participants in the studies. But I think there's pretty convincing evidence to show that there's no direct correlation between the presence or absence of a pulse, whether it be radial, carotid, or femoral, for instance, the ones we're commonly taught, and any specific blood pressure. And in fact, if, you know, I think the data has shown that if there is a pulse and you're using that rule, you're probably overestimating what the blood pressure actually is.
Overestimating? How? That, now I'm confused.
So yeah, what got me by that is
we are more likely to assume that, oh, you have a radial pulse. You said 90, I said 80. So we think their blood pressure is reasonable. Whether we think it's 90 or 80, that's semantics. The reality is you, and the average patient whose heart is working as hard as can be to maintain a pressure, you might feel a radial pulse when it's 68, 65, 62, 58. There's just so much variability as it gets lower to when that radial pulse disappears. Is that quick check, we're going to think it's higher than it actually is.
Exactly. Kevin just nailed it on the head. The problem here is that you can falsely reassure yourself, and that is a really really dangerous thing in medicine. You're feeling that radial pulse, and you feel comfortable. You feel like that person has a decent blood pressure. Turns out that that's not true. That person might still be really hypotensive.
Okay, so I could actually feel a radial pulse, and their systolic could be in the 40s?
Theoretically, that's pretty low, but you get someone with very little adipose tissue whose heart doesn't have to work very hard, and theoretically that could be true. The study did not have an example that low, but that doesn't mean it's not possible.
Are you sure about that? I was actually going to look up the study right now, but if you know for certain, I won't go dig it for the article.
No, I don't know for certain, but I'm pretty confident. If we go look at it, it didn't have that much variability.
40 seems pretty darn low. Pretty darn low.
I mean, I don't remember the exact numbers offhand, and we can look them up. That's pretty easy. But the general theme of the study that was done is that we were actually overestimating blood pressures based on this 60, 70, 80, 90 mantra that we're using. So in general, you can have a lower blood pressure and still sustain a radial pulse. So it's not safe to assume that your patient has a decent blood pressure just because they have a radial pulse, and that's the concern with this practice.
The lowest auscultated blood pressure in the radial pulse group was 52 systolic.
52, okay.
So you weren't far off. 48, 52, that's just Scott's got better ears than I have.
Okay. Well, wow, we're finding all kinds of stuff here that's like, whoa, wait a minute. Because we're already up to number 8, the golden hour, which is the 1 hour from time of injury to being under hot lights on cold steel. Is that another old wives' tale?
Well, I'll start this, and I'll kick it over to Kevin and Scott. But I'll tell you, the biggest concern with the golden hour that I have, it really goes back to lights and sirens use. And we don't have any proof that for anything other than non-traumatic cardiac arrest that rapid transport has any mortality benefit. But what we do have is a lot of proof that rapid transport causes a lot of ambulance accidents and a lot of deaths of not just ambulance occupants, but also innocent bystanders that were driving their car. And it's a big problem that we need to talk about in EMS. Until the proof comes out that rapid transport really makes a difference, I think that the whole theory of the golden hour has to be questioned because the risk is probably bigger than the benefit.
Okay, so the risks in this definitely outweigh the rewards.
Not in all patients. What the study we were referencing looked at was trauma patients as a whole. If you have a patient with low blood pressure who's in hemorrhagic shock, but you know is actively bleeding, and it's bleeding that you cannot control in the field, then every moment counts because they're losing blood and we need to get their bleeding stopped. That said, the patient who is bleeding uncontrollably, internally, who's bleeding you cannot tamponade with a tourniquet or something else, is not your average trauma patient. That is not the mean trauma patient that we see out in the field.
Okay, so that would be the zebra when we're looking for horses.
Correct.
Yeah.
Great analogy.
Okay.
I'll tell you, I mean, working before my years in EMS, but also now working at a trauma center, it's the times that we see a true arterial bleed that's uncontrollable or very difficult to control, that is a rare occurrence, a very rare occurrence.
Okay, I'm jotting down some notes for myself. It's a horse, not a zebra. Okay, and then, oh yes, a doctor's favorite thing, especially when they first came out in the 70s and during Vietnam when they were called the military anti-shock trousers or the pneumatic, the PASC, the old-fashioned mass trousers. From what I've been taught, they're nothing more than a good old fat. They're a very expensive pelvic splint. That's from what I've been taught.
Well, the first thing that I thought when we were outlining this article and we talked about all these articles before we generate them, and I said, do we even need to talk about this? I thought this problem was solved. I thought mass pants were gone, and apparently they're not.
There's some agencies here in my area that still have them under the squad bench. And
I think most often that's a result of state legislation that outlines required equipment in ambulances. That's in my experience in the past, not because there's some particular love for this device or belief that it works. It's that it's written into state law that an ambulance will have these things. And it's just unrealistic to expect that legislation is going to be rewritten to exclude them, or maybe just waiting for an opportunity in the future when that's going to happen. But that's in my experience as to why a lot of times these are still in ambulances. I worked for one agency that had the mass pants on the ambulance in a locked cabinet that you did not have a key to, so you could not use them, but they were on the ambulance in accordance with state law.
So they met the requirement. You had them.
It met the requirement, but the medical director was clear that you will not use those things.
Okay, now, just in case I get some brand new basics or first responders listening in who have no clue what they are, mass trousers, three compartments, and you pumped them up, starting with the legs until the Velcro started to scream, if I remember correctly.
Wait, I want to interject and say that if you have new basics that don't know what these are, that's a good thing, actually.
Well, they may end up listening to this and be like, what are mass trousers?
And go to the EMS museum and take a look at them if you don't know what they are. and look at them collecting dust and be really happy they're still there.
Yes, because I know, if I remember right, medics used to really get ticked off at physicians for cutting them, or nurses for cutting them. And it says in seven different places on there, do not cut. I even had to train on them for the Army. So the bottom line, they're not even good as a pelvic splint? Or would they be good for a leg splint or a pelvic splint?
No, I think as a pelvic splint, they can be useful. But there's probably a much cheaper way to devise a pelvic air splint than an entire mass trousers.
Yeah, I agree with Sean. I think as far as the literature showing where is there some benefit, it's always been a question. There may be some benefit as a pelvic sling, but we have commercial pelvic sling devices that aren't mass trousers and aren't as, quite frankly, as complicated to use, and have been shown to be effective in reducing bleeding from pelvic injuries.
Okay. Well, yeah, of course, I was taught a sheet also for pelvic. So
sure, that works just as well.
Okay, so the bottom line on the mask
sort of
is
pelvic, some sort of
go
pelvic
ahead.
Binding device. I also want to point out that we commonly, and we in our article, use the term military anti-shock trousers, but I think the original mythbuster for masks, Dr. Brian Bledsoe, he pointed out in one of his articles that the mask pants actually never saw any use in Vietnam, and they were actually originally termed the medical anti-shock trousers, and were a direct result of the G suits that were used, the gravity suits that were used by NASA, who was under congressional mandate to develop devices from their programs that would have civilian application, and the medical anti-shock trousers were a direct result of that. And Dr. Bledsoe, in his research with the military, determined had a pretty reliable historian, Colonel Warner Rocky Farr, he determined that the mask pants were probably never used in the Vietnam War. And they first came around in the late 1970s, and they were used. The first documented use was occasional use in the post-Granada invasion. So, you know, there's actually not even any evidence that they were ever used in the Vietnam War.
Now that's something I didn't know.
That was new to me, and that's coming from the medical myth master himself, Dr. Brian Bledsoe. I think we can all say influenced us. His work,
yes.
You know, probably influenced us in this in the generation of this article.
Yes. Well, I didn't know they weren't used until Grenada. Huh. Man, that was young. That was way young in my military career. Now your article only had 9. Is there a 10th? But is there a 10th so we can round it out as a top 10? You know, I've got the bad habit of not completely reading. I didn't read the calendar when I scheduled this. That's why we're doing a Monday night show.
Another trauma myth.
Yeah, if you happen to have another one handy that anybody can think of.
Well, so give me a second here, because our original article was actually going to have 15 myths, and we debated which ones to include.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm looking here to bring up the list to see exactly what we talked about.
I think the 10th myth, and part of the reason that we left it at 9, is to leave that 10th up to your imagination, because a lot of what we do is a myth. And it's really just EMS in general, a lot of the care that we provide. And for all the providers that are listening to this and that are out there every day, to think about each intervention that you're doing and to think about, is there evidence behind it? And if there is, you should understand it to continue doing it. And if there's not, maybe we should try to develop that evidence. And if there's evidence against it, we should stop doing it. But because all these things are myths until we prove them otherwise.
Okay. Now, there was one comment in the chat room that while we were talking about the mass trousers, the diver medic, he said that he read something somewhere that they were labeled as bad because air was let out of them fast instead of letting the air out slow, which caused issues. So
when we look at the mass trousers and what they actually do to the patient, let's take a step back and look at what their indications are for use. They were indicated and applied once a patient was already profoundly hypotensive. When that point arrives, that means the patient has already compensated. They've already peripherally vasoconstricted as much as their body can, and their blood pressure can no longer maintain itself. The body can no longer maintain any sort of peripheral perfusion, so it begins to shut down and just perfuse the core extremity, the core of the body and the heart and the lungs and the brain, even at a certain point begins to shut down the kidneys. So we know that as much of the blood as possible has already been diverted away from the extremities. Now the theory is we're going to apply the mass trousers and we're going to squeeze more blood out of the extremities and push it into the core. Logically, that just doesn't make sense if our body, which is our best vasoconstrictor, has already squeezed as much blood away as possible from the periphery. So what we found out in the trials that were done is you see at most a 5% increase in the blood pressure, which in a blood pressure of 60 systolic might be 7 or 8 points. So you go from 60 to 68 with inflation of the mass trousers, and that's going to last you about 5 to 8 minutes before it drops back down to the original base level. So it has nothing to do with the danger of deflation. It's the fact that it just doesn't do the job we thought it would set out to do in the hypovolemic patient.
Okay. I hope that cleared up a little bit for you there, diver medic. Yeah, he said he can't find the article from right now, but it was from a number of years ago. So basically, the bottom line on this is a lot of it is all in our assessments. That's what I'm gathering. 90% of it is most of how we assess and how we do things. Except for the now I got my pages all screwed up. All except for the lidocaine, and we all know that the backboard is a better bench than a immobilizer. So.
Assessments are everything. It is what we do the worst in EMS, and by that I mean we are the only medical profession that teaches a focused exam. No other field of medicine teaches you to just examine an ankle or just examine a leg or to just examine the head when a patient has a headache. Every other field of medicine teaches a holistic and patient assessment that is driven around the entire patient as a whole. We need to get away from that, and we need to look at the same patient as a whole the entire time and do the same whole body assessment on every single patient if we really want to improve our assessment skills and pick up on the subtle signs of our patients.
Okay. All righty. Seeing that I am now coming up on a few minutes left before Gertrude decides to rear her ugly head and tell me that it's, you know, time to go home, we'll start off with on top. Kevin, where can people find you on this wonderful interwebs machine?
You can find me on Twitter at the app symbol at KT Colopy, that's KTCOLLOPY. Or you can find me online on LinkedIn at KT Colopy as well, and then ktcolopy@gmail.com.
Okay, Dr. Kivlin, Sean, where can we find you at?
You can find me the same at Twitter at my name, Sean Kivlahan, and through the EMS World website, I'm pretty easily found there, LinkedIn, et cetera, or, you know, you come to EMS World to the expo in Vegas this year and come talk to me there. And we're always open to hearing any suggestions that you have for any future articles to try to make this thing better, because it's really all about all the providers out there and trying to get them the newest information.
Okay, and Scott, where can people find you at?
People can contact me at via email, scottrsnyder@mac.com. I'm not using Twitter as much nowadays, but you can also find me there, Scott R. Snyder, and via my LinkedIn account as well, Scott R. Snyder.
All right, thank you very much once again, gentlemen, for coming on tonight. Especially because, I say, tonight's show was due to my misreading of the calendar. I thought that the 4th was a Saturday. But it worked out great. I mean, as far as I know, Jimmy Fallon's ratings dropped about 3 viewers, and the bad jokes keep coming. So, once again, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on tonight, especially because I'm coming down to my 2-minute warning. And I hope to have you all again on soon, and definitely hope to run into you guys at Expo.
Thank you very much for having us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thanks.
Thanks again very much. That was Scott Snyder, Kevin Colopy, and Dr. Sean Kivlahan. We were knocking out some trauma myths. So let's go ahead and start winding things down because we're coming up on the 2-minute warning. Next show will be this Saturday night, Mother's Day weekend, and we are going to have the Paragods on, and they'll be talking about their 2nd season, and if I was reading what I saw on Facebook tonight, they may have had some bad news come to them, but I hope it's the opposite of what I've read. Let's see here, I got that one knocked out, so we got that. Then 2 weeks from this Saturday, which would be the 9 and 7 is 16, and 7, 20, the 23rd, we will have Jared Edgington on talking about the Reaper series. The Rhythms of the Night, nobody has answered them yet. Come on, I'm not going to give you the answer, but they are posted. The answers aren't, but the rhythms are. So take an eyeball at them. Nobody's answered them yet. I'm like, come on. I mean, I don't have anything to give you, but except maybe a pat on the back. So now that I'm down to... Yes, you will have to listen to the final version here shortly, Kevin, as soon as I get it posted. We're down to 1 minute, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap things up and call it good. Next show is Saturday night. For my normally silent co-host and call screener, D. Elmore, who is laying in bed under the weather right now. The whole night I've been in Studio B, the back porch of One Union 801 headquarters. This is One Union 801, the webcast on Blog Talk Radio. This show is a member of the ProMed Network. I'll see y'all on Saturday night.